So the title of the talk is The Middle Way into the Garden of Eden. Gan Eden, the middle way, the middle part. The word awakening is an important word of the 108 descriptions of the of liberation, of Nibbana. Awakening is perhaps an important one, because the Buddha himself used it when he was asked, who are you? And are you a god, or are you a prince, or are you a king? You're an amazing figure. And he said, actually, no, I'm just awake. I woke up. And it is an important description of where we are, because it brings into our awareness the idea that we're asleep. And this is interesting. What does it mean we're asleep? What do we wake up from? And you might think, well, sleep is tiredness, is blankness, is boredom, is anesthesia, hardama, it's all of that is sleep, and we wake up from that. But that's not sleep. Sleep is defined as the second noble truth, which is attachment. Hitsamdut. That's sleep. Sleep of being attached. What do we attach to? To our own construction. That the world which we construct, me and the world which is we construct, and we are then in it, regarded as totally real, as that's the truth, even though we made it, we forget we made it, that's the truth, and that's called sleep. Traditionally, there's four kinds of attachment. Attachment to the senses, kama, upadana kama. Attachment to, that means attachment to pleasure, to what I want, to what I like, what I don't like. Second is ditti, views, attachment to opinions, views I have. Views of myself, views of the other, views of life, views or hashkafot, or what I think. The third is sila, is attachment to rules, attachment to ethics, or ethical rules, forms, gurus, teachings, teachers, and all of that. And the big one is attachment, atta, to self. And attachment or to the idea of self. Because there isn't a self, and self is an idea or a thought. A strong one, big one, but it's still a thought. It's not something. So attachment to that, the self. And sleeping or ignorance is the way we build sankharas, we build constructions, we build patterns, we build habits, we build identity, we build our mental landscape. And we keep maintaining this all the time, every time we think or do, every moment of our life. We keep rebuilding the construction, and reconstructing all the time. And it brings a very strong belief. The belief in me, that I am a person, I am Stephen, I am like this, and I do this, and this is me, and this is my world, and my things, and my house, and my, and the world is like that. There is such a thing as a country, or there is such a thing as objects, there is such a thing as it looks like that, everything looks like that. So we build belief, and we take it all as real. So it's the belief that's the problem, that it's as it is, as we apparently see it. The senses are not a problem. There's no problem with the senses, chushim. They're just functioning, letting in light, the eye. The belief, the attachment, is the issue. Because they, basically, the problem is that it's not real. It's a construction we make ourselves, and it's not real. And very often not useful. Because we make a construction and then we suffer from the construction that we make. I mean, an example, tragic example, right now is what's happening in Syria. When you think about how maybe it just occurred to me today, how long will it take before some people wake up there, the country is destroyed, the people are starving, the children are traumatized, there's nearly a couple of million refugees living in tents, there's 100,000 people killed, and maybe sometime they'll wake up and say, was that helpful? Well, is this helpful? Is this doing anything? But there's an illusion which is so total that it's everyone is caught in it, and it's such a tragedy, but you can see that it's a tragedy that's created itself. It's created by a view, or them and us, and it's a view. It's attachment to a view. And you can wake up from that view and say, is this doing anything? Is this helping anybody? You can wake up. So the view or the reality which we believe and we think is so solid puts us in a kind of matrix, like the film, the movie, Matrix. It's like we feel, it feels like that's the sleep. We're inside a kind of matrix. I actually once saw a wonderful take on the Matrix called The Matrix. Anyone saw it ever? So it's done, it's a animation done by a group in the UK, in England, to support vegetarian. And it's about a whole group, a whole farm of pigs. And they're all happy. But there's two pigs that woke up. And they were trying to kind of tell him, you're going to be eaten. You're here just being, look, you're here just, you're eating, happy, sitting, eating, and soon, you know, you're being bred by a farmer. You're in a kind of matrix, not a matrix kind of. You don't realize that. Wake up, guys. What helps us wake up? And here is something which is a message that's like 50% of all the Dharma teaching that we do all the time. I don't know, 50%, but it's a lot. What helps us wake up is the recognition of pain and suffering. Pain and suffering are our biggest friends. In an obvious way, pain is just telling us, wake up, there's something wrong. That's what pain is. Pain in the knee is telling you, you know, there's something you need. Emotional pain is wake up, something is wrong. Dukkha is a friend because it points us to a place where we need to wake up, we need to pay attention, where things are not fitting. We don't fit the life process. The life process, it doesn't listen to our belief, to our expectation, to our reality. Reality is not the same. And the mismatch, the ihatama between life that's free and our construction in the matrix, the mismatch is dukkha, where one hits the other. For example, what I want and what life provides. It doesn't provide what I want. Life is just life. It's not busy trying to do what I want. The sapek, life is not busy trying to give me. Life is life. And this mismatch is dukkha. Gives us dukkha. But if we see it like that, dukkha then is a friend. It tells us when we need to wake up and get out, and something needs to be changed, shaken up. The view is mistaken in some way. We're not, that's not the way things are. Life is telling us that, and we need to listen. And it's telling us through dukkha, through discomfort or dissatisfaction. And then, at that point, we practice, and we begin to, hopefully, we begin to look a little bit underneath the reality which we've constructed, the belief in it, and begin to question it. And the way we question it in Vipassana is by just sitting down and looking at what it is going on really in our, starting with very, very simple things, the breath, the body, the the ground I walk on. Really, really simple things. We start with that and see how we made a construction and how this construction is not entirely true. The story. It's not the story. And the first whisper we get of breaking that attachment story is the three characteristics of anicca, anatta, and dukkha. They are the whisper, the first message that we get to say, wait a minute, the constructions are not 100% true. Anicca tells us that any object that we thought was real and a thing, and including the self, and there, and we believe it to be there real, and Nietzsche tells us this object is actually a dynamic field of change. It is not a thing. That's the first message we get of breaking down our dukkha. Tells us our reactions to this. It tells us we have reactions. So we react to that, like I say, mismatch between what we built and the belief in it and the reality of change. The mismatch is giving us dukkha. And anatta does the same with the subject, the me. It's not so solid as we thought. Right view, samaditi, the view, actually goes on from there, from the three characteristics, which are these whispers of doubt in the solidity of attachment. It goes on from there to question the whole of duality that we make. Right view begins with anicca, anatta, dukkha, and carries on to undo the whole thing, basically the whole duality of me and the world. For example, there's a sutta called on right view, called Kacchanagata Sutta, and the Buddha says, this world generally takes as its object a duality, existence and non-existence. But when you see something that comes to be as it is, with right of view, right eyes, then it doesn't occur to you, non-existence doesn't occur to you. You see something arising, it can be a thought, it doesn't occur to you that this thought is no thought, is nothing. It's something arising. And when one sees something disappearing, the ending of something, it doesn't occur to you, there is something here. It's finished. It's ended. So, you're seeing, in other words, what he's saying is you're seeing the beginning and ending, the arising, fully acknowledging that things arise and disappear. Generally, this world is tied to attachments, holding on, bias. But one who has right view doesn't get involved with or doesn't hold on to these attachments and fixations and biases and obsessions and beliefs in the mind, nor is he sure about myself. He has no uncertainty, though, that just dukkha, when it comes, it comes. And when it passes, it passes. And to that extent, there is right view. So, in other places, the Buddha was talking about the tendency we have for very deep to make the world into a duality. There is existence or non-existence. There is, I want to be somebody or I don't want to be somebody. I want to exist or I don't want to exist. This is not just, we don't think, you know, sit there and thinking, I want to exist or I don't want to exist. But if we take it more subtly or more in terms of human life, we say, I enjoy my life. That means I want to exist. Or, I don't enjoy my life. I want to finish. I don't like. I'm depressed. Non-existence. I'm a happy and energetic and loving existence. I want existence. I want something. I want life. I don't want non-existence. I don't like. Push away. I like myself. Existence. I don't like myself. Non-existence. So it's a duality to do with deep duality of wanting and not wanting and existence and non-existence, which goes into philosophy of nihilism or determinism. Won't go into it now. But it leads to an important issue, which is the middle way. And the middle way is, for many, is the description of the Buddhist way. The Buddha himself says, I teach the middle way. And the middle way has become the kind of title of the Buddhist teaching, called the middle, it's the middle way. And it's usually understood, is often understood as a balance. So that it's like Derech HaEmtza or Shvil HaZahav. It's usually, middle way is often seen as a balance, and indeed it has that quality, that we really don't need to go to extreme. For example, in the Buddhist time, lots of yogis were punishing themselves with standing on one leg for 10 years and sitting on beds of nails and punishing the body as a way of getting out of the body. And the Buddha said, you don't need to do that. It's unnecessary. It's also very unpleasant. And instead, the middle way. Take the middle road. Take something more balanced. And our practice here is, in a way, influenced by that. Not to even what I said just the beginning of this evening. Kind of let go form, but hold form also. In other words, find a middle way which works right for us. So, the middle way is the Eightfold Path is defined as the middle way. The whole Buddhist path is defined as the middle way. Middle way then is right living, right speaking, right thought and intention, right meditation. It's kind of got this. But the middle way is also not a compromise, shara, It's not a kind of middle ground which is neither this nor that. Parva, say. It actually goes beyond duality completely. For example, one sadhu kept coming to the Buddha with these very good questions. It's called Vachagota. And the texts are full of Vachagota, this Indian sadhu, who kept asking the Buddha these good questions. And one of the questions he asked the Buddha was, is there a self or is there not a self? The Buddha was silent. And after that, the monk said to him, "What? Why were you silent? It's a good question, isn't it?" He said, "No, it's not a good question, because anything I would answer would generate duality. If I said there is a self, it would turn into a belief, an ideology, a fact, a thing called a self. If I said there's not a self, it would turn into a thing or ideology called emptiness, a thing, and again duality. It's far more subtle than that. So whatever answer I would give, I would fall into the same trap. Better to be silent." And his silence is all through the Buddhist teaching, which is when faced with duality, this or that, you look for another way. Duality is not the answer. In the case of Vachagota, he was silent. In the case of other questions, he would say, what's the middle way? Paticca-samuppada, meaning the dynamic arising of things. In other words, we think there's a world, but if you look more carefully, we are making the world. Therefore, there cannot be a world existing. And is there a self? If you look carefully, we are selfing ourselves all the time. Therefore, there cannot be a self. Because the whole thing is moving and dynamic. And there isn't a thing there. And there isn't a thing out there. There isn't a thing in here. It's all moving life. It's all dynamic process of change. So we see what we make is what we see. And Nagarjuna, the philosopher, took this text of the Vachagota and one or two other similar texts and wrote a book called The Middle Way, and it's become the major philosophical book, I think, Buddhist book of all time. And it's given the description, the middle way, to the Buddhist teaching, I think more from Nagarjuna than anybody else. But he really, really put the stamp, I would say, as a philosopher, a thinker, and a practitioner, on there is no duality. And nothing is fixed. There is no boundary. He said, not this, not this, not this, not this. Anything you look at, it's not it. So birth and death, duality, what is it? Is it real? We think of birth and death. It's in our mind, birth and death. But it needs time. Where is time? In life or in my head? Coming and going. Like Einstein. Einstein in here is a bit of a Nagarjuna. Where is coming, where is going? It's all relative. Who knows which is coming, which it depends where you are. So therefore there isn't such a thing as coming and going. Being and not being. Do we know the difference? What is being, what is not being? In the process of change, I have a view. This is being, this is not being. But in life, stream of life, where is being, where is not being? Where is Where is place? Where is here? Can you say where is here? I don't know where is here. Here is where I say is here. If someone else would say here is here. Someone else would say here is here. Reminds me of my time in India. In last time I was there for a while, I was teaching in a school, Krishnamurti school, and it was in Varanasi, and I was there for a year, and there was a big school, which was quite sort of middle class, 600 school kids living there, and on the other side was a poor village. And the village's name was Ispar. And I asked what that mean to the villagers. They said, it means over there. I said, but you're here. Yes, but they called us over there. Like the Krishnamurti, because they were middle class and so on, that the village is called over there. Ispar means over here, was this side of the river, the Varuna. The other side of the Varuna was the village called over there. So that's their name. They call themselves over there. So where's here? Where's there? You know, again, if we look at anything, it breaks down. The duality doesn't exist. It is our attachment that makes it. However, this is rather scary. This is rather scary. Because if everything falls down, so what can I hang on to? If I'm making my world and it's just self-made, I mean by self-made I also mean human beings make it and so on, not just, but so where's the ground? Where is the reality, actually? So it's scary to really say, and deeply in our way we get up in the morning, to really know this, that there is no here and there, and there is no me and other, and there is no, in the end, place and boundary. We can act in life, we have to act as it. But it's scary. And although we, for the purpose of wisdom, we do need to question these things, and in the end we come out of it better. But we get lost. And a Krishnamurti gathering that I was at some time back, when someone said, how do you travel the pathless path, which is the title of the talk by Sandhya yesterday, and someone else said, you get lost! That's how you travel the pathless path. Just get lost. In other words, you have to get lost to get out of the matrix. The matrix will hold you tight. You have to get lost. Because it's as if the matrix is all the known. The construction. And to get out of the matrix, you need to get lost. But I have a nice poem that gives you a little bit of support. And it's a poem, American, so-called American Indian poem, but you never know. Never mind. And it says, what shall I do if I get lost? And the answer is, stand still. The trees before you and the bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is a place called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger, both asking to know and to be known. Listen. The forest whispers, I have made this place. You can leave and return again and say, here. No two trees are the same to the raven. No two branches are the same to the wren. Wren is a little bird. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, you don't know it, then you are truly lost. Stand still. Listen. The forest knows where you are. Let it find you. So we may be lost, but the earth, as I was talking to the group today, in a way the earth is our witness, as said, as the Buddha pointed out when he was awakened. And he was asked by Mara, are you crazy or are you, how do we know that you're awakened? And he didn't answer, he just pointed to the earth and said, the earth is witness. And there's something about the earth that is witness to us. And gives us the sense that we may be lost, but it's in relation to what we already built inside ourselves. We have to, in a way, lose ourselves to find the world. Lose ourselves, meaning lose the constructions in consciousness to find the world. And the world is waiting for us. And the world is our witness. And we do this, and we're practicing here, in a way, in two directions. Remember I talked about the object and the knower. The knowing and the knower. The practice of breaking the attachments is in both sides. We break the attachments to self and to the objects, namely to the world. So the self needs to be questioned. Anatta. What is going on here? What is this thing here? We need to question inside. What's really happening when the subject knows something? Is there really a subject inside? What is going on? What? How is this thing happening called I know? So we question this. And the question can be many different ways of questioning. There are Advaita teachers that say, you know, you just question, you just ask. I am, who am I, who am I? Zen teachers also, who am I, who am I? And the place where Advaita teachers like Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj and Papaji and all the Neo-Advaita, but also the ancient Advaita teacher, where they meet the Dharma, is in not so much asking who am I, but just touching and staying with mindfulness, the subject, meaning the self, actually seeing the self as a thought or a form in consciousness. Staying with that selfing, with the eye of mindfulness, breaks it open. And Nisargadatta Maharaj had a very nice way of expressing this. He said that the self is a good place to meditate on, because it has two faces. One face is the person, and the other face is the ultimate, Hamisgav, Nisgav, Hamukhlat. So in other words, the self has a face pointing to the divine, and a face pointing to the person. And if we stay there with the self, it will be an access, a doorway to the divine, to beyond. Because it's such a total thing, the self, that when we stay with it, it takes us beyond. The other side is we question the world. I gave a talk based on a Tibetan phrase last year, last summer, called "You Are the Eyes of the World." It's quite a dramatic sentence. In other words, we think we are looking, but that's the masach, that's the veil. It cannot be anything other than the world looking out of our eyes. How can it be that the world, that is our eyes? It has to be the world's eyes. It cannot be anything other than the world looking out of our eyes. We have, shall we say, on the way, baderech, as the world is looking out of our eyes, we catch this and say, it's me, on the way. But it cannot be there. So this is an example where the world, touching the world, questioning, opening the world and us, this duality, a field of very powerful practice, breaking the attachments. Diving into self, and trying to see what's there, and diving into world, seeing what's there. And it always comes out with a non-dual answer. This amazing koan, Zen koan, what's the sound of one hand clapping? You've probably all heard of it. And it's a beautiful koan because it's exactly about duality. So if you take away one hand, what's the sound of one hand clapping? And there's a writer, brilliant spiritual philosopher called Ken Wilber, that joked, the sound of one hand clapping is the Big Bang. Which is amazing because the Big Bang is still happening. And it's non-dual. It's not dualistic. We're still hearing it. It's in the creation of the world. That everything is living. And it's... And you can, there's no two in that. And it jumps all these ways of practicing break through the dualistic mind. In Zen, they try and exhaust the dualistic mind. They like present puzzles that the mind can't solve, and when the mind gives up, matish, the mind gives up, then there is a window to the truth. The truth comes in when the mind is exhausted and can't do it anymore, can't hold the duality anymore. And it's always the case, and all through the Buddhist teaching, it's the case that whenever there's concept about, even about the path and about the reality and about any time, the Buddha never brought argument, which is trying to fight one concept with another concept, because it stays in the realm of concept, but always took it out to somewhere else completely, a bigger space, a puzzle, a place that has no answer, a place that the mind can't go, a place where ein sibatiyut, ein lineariyut, just there's no logic. Like, there's no logic in "you are the eyes of the world." This Tibetan phrase, "you are the eyes of the world." What does it mean? How can logic get you there? The logic doesn't tell you, cannot hold that. Well, I am the eyes of the world from my eyes. And it's same with the practice, that we don't actually struggle. We try not to struggle with attachments. because it creates more attachment. So we're trying to be wise and get out of attachment by being in another place. You know how it is, in a very simple way, if you're trying to give up smoking cigarettes or eating too much food, how difficult it is if you say, I must stop. And then you fail, and then tomorrow, okay, now I'm going to stop. It doesn't work tomorrow. And how sometimes people coming on retreat said, I've been smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. As soon as I come to the retreat, I forgot about cigarettes. I don't know how it happened. The context changes. There's less struggle against attachment, which is in the same duality. I must stop smoking cigarettes. I must stop smoking cigarettes. There's other ways to do things. The Buddha said, how do you cross the flood? By not stopping and by not struggling, by not standing still and by not struggling, I think. If I struggle or strive, pushed to swim, I got swept away. If I stood still, I got sunk. So I didn't stand still and I didn't swim or struggle. There's a place which is neither this nor that. You don't stand still and you don't push against or you don't run. There's a place which is, this is still duality. A place which is not this, not this, not this, not this. Something changes, and you know how it is with us. When we change, usually we don't know how it happened. We can't, it's not ensibatiyu. We can't understand it. We're simply in another place. One day it happened that I didn't need a cigarette. How, why, what? One day it happened that I felt life was less of a problem. I don't know how it happened. I don't know what happened. The place of being, havaya, the place of awareness, simple awareness, is a place of transformation because it cuts through the duality. And in that place, a lot of our problems are solved by themselves. We actually don't have to work to struggle and untie all the knots. I'm amazed in this retreat how little takim there are for the teachers. I've never, in teaching, 20 years teaching, I have never had a retreat with less notes. Yeah, really. Never had a retreat with less notes. No notes. Ain't takim. And I had a doubt, well, maybe everything we're saying is so far out that nobody understands anything, so nobody knows what to ask. But there's another thought that maybe, you know, the place of being is actually making all the usual things that people bring Ptakim for, like, I'm tired, or like, I'm pissed off with the food, or what do I do with how am I going to go back home afterwards, or I've got a relationship problem, how is retreat going to solve that, or I don't know. You know, that's the notes often. Nothing. And I like to think, I hope to think, well, let's say it's a bracha also, it's a blessing, maybe. That because we're in a place of being, and this retreat is about being and not about duality or forms or thoughts that I have or whatever, that these knots, sharim, issues, are actually slowly becoming less important for us. And that's the way that the Dharma solves problems, by the way. It doesn't solve problems dualistically. It solves problems by being a bigger container. To be a mechil yoter gadol, and then suddenly all the problems are no longer so important. That's the way the problems are solved in the Dharma. We do not try and fight them or even understand them. Sibatiut, because what happened to me when I was 3 years old, therefore I have. We don't. We just create a bigger space where the problems just don't take up any room anymore. They'll just know they don't take interest. They don't have space. The space is big, so they're not issues anymore. And it's all anything, life and death, the whole thing. So the image of Gan Eden, I'm going to finish with that, because it's quite a sweet image that, you know, as a myth, it's right on. As a primal myth, it's right on. And the reason it's right on is because the tree of Eitz Hadat, that in consciousness of Tovra or Tovli Rali, it's really a great image, because it's the Dat, the Tovli Rali is in the knowledge, it's not out there in the world, Tovra is not out there, it's in the consciousness, in the knowing, and we ate it. It's inside us. We ate this fruit of the Eitz Dat Tovra. It's in, we took it inside, so it's us. And a problem, we're in Gan Eden. We never left Gan Eden. We have to be in Gan Eden. There isn't any other place except Gan Eden. It's crazy to think that there is such a thing as the Girush Mi Gan Eden. There's no such thing. We are in it, but we just got stuck up the wrong tree. We have to go to the other tree, the tree of life, and sit down under there and let go and relax and let life take us. And it can be a bit of a journey sometimes. Doesn't that mean it's entirely easy? Some of you finding it a little struggle to meeting on the journey. We sometimes meet the dark night of the soul. We do sometimes have to go through passageways, go through, because it may not be 100% easy. But I don't think that from the journey of the tree of life, of the tree of Tovli Rali to the tree of life, I don't think there really is any other journey for us. I don't believe there's anything else that a aware human being needs to do in this life. Otherwise we're just functioning on automat from birth to death. So we don't really have a choice. But it's a great delight. It's a great delight to sit under the tree of life. It's a huge delight.